This episode is brought to you by FinditNWA.com, your hyper-local business directory connecting you with the best of Northwest Arkansas. Whether you're looking for a new place to eat, a trusted service provider, or unique local shops, FinditNWA has you covered. We also highlight businesses with a featured listing on the site. That means if you're a small business owner in NWA, you could be next. Discover more at FinditNWA.com.
It's time for another episode of I Am Northwest Arkansas, the podcast covering the intersection of business, culture, entrepreneurship, and life in general here in the Ozarks. Whether you are considering a move to this area or trying to learn more about the place you call home, we've got something special for you. Here's our host, Randy Wilburn.
Today on I Am Northwest Arkansas, we're diving into the artistry of woodworking with someone who redefines what it means to build with purpose. Matt Buell didn't pick up woodworking until nearly 30 years of age, but now he's a national award-winning designer, a contributor to FDMC Magazine, which stands for Furniture Design Manufacturing Cabinetry Magazine, and a mentor to the next generation of makers. From bespoke restaurant interiors in Bentonville to empowering young apprentices, Matt's story is one of passion, precision, and the creative spirit of Northwest Arkansas. I'm excited to have Matt on I Am Northwest Arkansas today for the first time ever. Matt's a dear friend. I met him years ago when I first moved here. We were looking at possibly getting a table made for our dining room, and Matt gave me some guidance and some actually really good advice around woodworking and specifically around furniture. And so I never forgot that. And so I've always stayed in touch with Matt. And, you know, I finally said, you know, I need to have you on this podcast. So without further ado, I want to welcome Matt Buell to the I Am Northwest Arkansas podcast. Matt, how are you doing today?
I'm good. Grateful to be here.
That's awesome.
I'm now officially uncomfortable. I don't think anyone said anything that nice about me in a long time.
So, yeah, I wanted to make Matt blush. So that was, mission accomplished. So no, that's awesome. I want to jump into this because actually I have some selfish reasons to sit down with you today and have this conversation. And one is that as a father of three young men, one is two teenagers and then one that's just recently turned 20. And as I think about, you know, just the arc and the progression of young people in general with their careers and everything, I think that your story is really powerful. And I want this to be an episode that people could really kind of connect with and maybe get some insight and information that will help them as they navigate trying to help their kids adult and figure life out. So what I would love for you to kind of talk about how you personally came to woodworking later in life, 30 years of age. I mean, that's at a time when people are starting families and doing other things. You're developing a whole new career. What lit the spark for you?
Ooh, oh man. One word summary, I guess, would be danger. I was in a weird spot in life. I had just moved back here and it was kind of going through some life transitions, to put lightly. And so I didn't have a family of my own or really a career or anything budding at the time. And it burned me alive when I realized it. And I was working in a jail, actually, as a substance abuse counselor, and which is heavy. It's heavy stuff. And I was coming home with some, you know, I'm carrying a lot of heaviness that's not mine and trying to unpack it when I get home. And I was still pretty immature. So I just needed something to do with my hands a lot of nights. And I missed playing music. And I kind of had this idea that it would be fun to maybe just take old electric guitar bodies and sand them and strip them down and, you know, refinish them and stuff. Even though I had no knowledge of using any tool whatsoever. And I got into it and I started building like this little, I had a carport, which is horrible for woodworking, outdoor elements, but I didn't know then.
Yeah.
And I remember I bought a router and that was the moment I knew. I didn't really understand what a router was, but I knew I had to have one. And with no tutelage at all, I hooked it up and tried using it, and it was brutal. Really dangerous. I am really lucky that
you still have all your digits.
Yeah, we don't even talk about that. That's bad juju.
I know.
But it was pretty wild. And that thing, it sent some material back at me, and But I should have been scared of it. And I just remember this feeling I had that was like, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And to this day, over what, 17 years later, I never finished the first guitar. And that's, I mean, my first job was 6 months later. I quit my job, started a business. Everyone thought I was crazy. And rightfully so from their perspective, I just didn't care.
Yeah.
A calling. Like I just knew right then, like, this is it.
Yeah.
So at that moment, I just made a commitment that I was willing to sacrifice whatever I had to do. And I was willing to go to any length to be functionally good enough at it to make a living. I remember after my first job, I did 20 chairs. And according to other guys that know their stuff or knew their stuff at the time, I didn't. They all considered them master level chairs. I'm not calling myself that.
Sure.
It was very hard.
Yeah.
I got the job done. I was finally working on my first table. And I remember the thought I had, I was like, you know what? One day down the road, maybe in 20 years from now, I can be considered, maybe I'll be one of the best furniture makers in the region.
Yeah.
And I laugh. I get so frustrated because I haven't succeeded enough when the truth of the matter is I won my first national award 3.5 years later.
Really?
Yeah.
Man.
But well over 10,000 hours later.
Yeah.
I lived in that shop. I lost relationships, literally.
Yeah.
Because I was never home. I took 2 days off the first year.
Yeah.
And every day was 10, 12 hours because I had to pack as much learning as I could to catch up with people that have been doing it for 10 years or third generation, which most of my peers at this point are.
What do you think it was about your personality that lent itself to the work, that the amazing work that you do? And it's funny because, you know, I told somebody I was sitting down to have this conversation with you. I was going to feature you on the podcast, and they were like, oh, Matt's stuff is amazing. You got to, I mean, it's awesome. Yeah. And I've actually, anecdotally, several people that, you know, unsolicited sort of like, oh yeah, Matt Buell is truly gifted. So I'm curious to know for you, what was it that was, I mean, at 30, some kind of light bulb came on in your inner man that woke up something that probably, like you said, was, you called it a calling. It's something that was probably inside of you. And then it fully manifested itself in your skill set and ability that was sitting dormant for 30 years.
I've always been creative, I guess. I mean, I have a hard time talking about it because I feel like the whole creative stuff is almost getting a little cliche. And I know that sounds snobby, but it's just been my experience. But the facts are I've always been interested in creative endeavors, whether it's music or painting. And I was always decent at most creative things I tried, but none of them ever felt like it was the medium that I was going to flourish in. And the irony really was that it found me when I stopped looking, which usually the good stuff does.
Yeah.
So I think those aspects of who I am as a person probably had a lot to do with it, because even though when I first started, I really couldn't wield the tools efficiently or effectively in a masterful way to get the results I was seeing in my head that I wanted. But once I recognized it was possible, it was on.
Yeah.
I mean, my obsession with tooling for the first 3 years, most people thought I was obsessed with machinery and tooling because I had to be a hyper-vigilant student.
Yeah.
But my obsession wasn't the tooling itself. I would obsess over the tooling because I understood what that certain tool or machine was going to allow me to accomplish. But I think my personality, I'm intense. I think that bodes well for this work. I can be obsessive. I think that bodes well for this work. I am prideful, even in good and bad ways. That bodes well for this work. I'm stubborn, which has really saved me because I've refused to quit so many times when I easily could have.
Yeah.
But I think over all of that, though, just love for it.
Yeah.
If you don't love it, all your other motivations eventually will kind of peter out.
As a child growing up, did you whittle? Did you have any relationship with wood at all?
The only relationship I had with wood would be repairing fence boards with my dad on the farm.
Okay.
And saying, here, hold this board while I do everything.
Right, right.
No, but I will say this, credit where credit's due, as much as I really resented farm work growing up, because what 15-year-old kid does like farm work?
No.
It taught me a lot. Like, I can take hits and keep going.
Yeah. You know?
So I'll give my family upraising credit for that. I don't know. I've always just kind of excelled really well when I've just been able to move at the pace that I see fit, whether it's fast or slow.
Yeah.
And woodworking, I've gone fast for a slow craft.
Right. Well, and I mean, I think, you know, it's not that it's a dying art, but there just aren't a lot of people that are becoming intimate with wood, if you will, from a career perspective. You know, and you and I have spoken about this because I actually had my middle son come out and spend a day with you, just kind of learning a little bit about what you do and how you do it. And I, first of all, I appreciated that, but
good for me.
Yeah, but I mean, I see how you give back to this next generation in terms of helping them to identify that space where they can actually create and do something interesting. What is it for you that continues to just push the needle and push the envelope on a regular basis, 17 years into it, since that time when you were 30 and you discovered it? Because you've come a long way, as they say, right?
Oh, yeah.
That used to be a commercial. You've come a long way, but you've done a lot.
Yeah, and I don't mean to say, oh, yeah, like I'm being arrogant. It's me, just I'm a sober-minded person grounded in reality, and I don't spend a lot of time going back and looking at my past works.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, I can look at some of my early stuff and to where it's in the evolution of where it kind of went. And yeah, I mean, I started from nothing and with no skills or knowledge. So, you know, the ceiling was high.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, I've worked really hard to always improve. A lot of that is maybe just who I am. Like, I don't know how to put this. I want to make money. I'm a business first and foremost because the money allows me to keep doing it. But as a father, and now that I'm older, I obviously the money allows to pay for vacations,
other stuff, know,
doctor bills, and all right. The things that us parents do. But beneath all of that, it's simple. It's the pursuit of excellence. Like, if you're not aiming for that, then what are you doing?
Yeah.
You know, I'm never going to be the best woodworker ever.
Right.
But I have to aim at something. And if I can just aim at that, even if I'm way off, that's still probably pretty good.
Right. You know?
I've never liked the idea of like, I've made one piece and I'm just going to hang my hat on that and not grow. That seemed like a bad business model. Good business model for like a 5-year run.
Yeah.
But for a sustainable model, not. And boring.
Hmm.
Like, I don't get to push myself.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the best thing about woodworking is it's jazz. I mean, John Coltrane and Miles Davis would not tell you they mastered jazz.
Right.
They'd say, I'm still learning.
Yeah.
And that's the one thing I love about it is, pretty boundless.
Is there such thing? I mean, since you mentioned one of the purest American art forms in jazz, is there such a thing as improvisation with woodworking?
Well, for me, yes.
What does that look like?
However, it really depends on the piece. I think with some of my more sculptural elements that I do, a lot of it's complete improvisation. I mean, I don't know how many times I've just had everything glued up with a rough shape in mind. And then I just grab a pencil after it's all assembled in, you know, three-dimensional reality. And I just start tracing lines where I think they need to go.
Yeah.
And then I just fire up the cutters and put on a bunch of protective gear and go.
Yeah.
However, a little battle plan never hurt.
Sure, like, sure.
But yeah, that's my favorite part of building is just kind of going into it with a vision and a rough idea of where you're going with it. I don't get to enjoy that as much these days.
Yeah.
Because
production schedules.
Yeah. It's a high class problem. Mm-hmm. It's because I stay so booked with commissions that, you know, where everything is very agreed upon and said as it should be.
Yeah.
That element's not as there. So it's funny. I just did an article for FDMC about that, about remembering to set a little bit of time aside to have a little fun with it.
Yeah.
So that you don't get burnt out.
Yeah.
And that's on my schedule soon, hence the shop being clean. That's part of my regimen. I clean.
Well, actually, the shop is super clean. And I think the last time I was here, you were apologizing because it wasn't up to your standards.
No, it was not.
And,
like a bomb went off.
You know, but I mean, it's really clean it's like pristine for a wood shop. And you've got just about every tool known to man in here to do just about everything. So
I don't know. You say that. I mean, there's two or three I can get.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure.
You know what? It is. I've been pretty fully stocked machinery for 6-7 years. And even I'm getting so used to it that I get on to myself. I'm like, I'm getting soft.
Yeah.
Because I started, I had like, I don't know, a couple pawn shop tools and $100.
Yeah.
And I couldn't even build a box.
Well, I mean, that's a good point, though. I mean, it doesn't take much to get into this craft. It takes a lot to stay in it. Yeah.
Well, it really just depends on what you're going to be doing. Yeah. The machinery is expensive.
Yeah.
And it cutting the check for these suckers out of money I'd earned. That was
whew, it hurts. It was real.
I think they're all paid. No, there's still a couple I'm paying off.
You'll get there.
No, they're worth it.
Yeah.
I've bought machines that paid themselves off in two jobs.
Sure. You mentioned that to me. We had a preliminary conversation. You said woodworking saved you. Can you unpack that a little bit more in terms of what that represents to you just for your life, right? And again, I think we all look for something. Some of our self-worth is defined by the work that we do. Not all of it. Some of it is. And, you know, I'm personally going through creating a talk about, you know, why it's important for all of us as human beings to live our best life. And even if we've gotten to a point where we're beyond that halftime point, we still need to be striving to live our best life. And I'm actually working on a talk that's going to be a TED talk called It's Never Too Late to Do the Thing That You're Called to Do. So for you at 30, woodworking saved you. Can you kind of just unpack that a little bit and what that represented for you?
Yeah, I would say I moved back here when I was about 28 and I had kind of been on a long walkabout. I mean, I'd you know, done the whole college degree thing. And I think right before I moved back, I was even in graduate school. I was only about six classes short of a master's and taking a national exam to be a licensed clinician. And but I had some stuff going on in my personal life that I don't think I was very well. And I came back here to kind of just, I don't know, get my act together, so to speak, or just breathe. And I felt very rudderless or just without direction. And I was working in the jail, which was a great job. And I, the people I worked with in there, I'll never forget. But I was still probably I was too emotionally immature to handle the load of that kind of work. And I found woodworking, in, like I mentioned, in the evenings, kind of as respite, I think, from not really understanding how to process some of the heavy stuff in there. And so woodworking was one of the first things in my life I really felt like, you know, like almost like in a movie where someone's walking and they're stuck in a giant cornfield and they can't see anything. Then all of a sudden the wind blows and the path just opens, you know, and all of a sudden the stalks of the corn move and it opens for them, you know. And that's really how I really took it. It felt very much like providence. Like it was just, I don't know. I knew in my bones it's what I needed to be doing. And that was saving in itself. Because before that, I'm not sure I ever really had an idea of what I needed to be doing, regardless of how much I tried to find things to do. And I still do that. I do that with a lot of things outside of woodworking these days. I just try and be open. You know, if something interests me, then I chase it down. As long as I'm not hurting anybody or myself or going back on my word, okay. And the funniest thing is, a lot of the things I'll chase down outside of woodworking always end up coming back into woodworking. You know, like I love basketball. I love watching basketball. And I'll get real into it during the playoffs, especially. I designed a piece based off watching an offense play because I thought that the movement was beautiful. And so I just started memorizing the movement. All of a sudden you can see lines, right? I'm like, oh, I can use that.
What was the piece?
Oh, it was a piece. It was a table. It was a column table. Several years ago, it didn't have a name. It was a smaller dining table.
But it was inspired by what you saw on the basketball court. Yeah.
Or I was studying Tinker Hatfield, the shoe designer.
Okay.
I got a couple ideas from him. It's everywhere all the time. Huh. And that's really where I've gotten my best stuff, is just being open. And not in some kind of hocus pocus way. Just being open that there's probably something beautiful around me. If I don't see it, the problem's probably me.
So do you feel that in your practice today and the woodworking that you do, that there's always something new to discover?
Yes. Not as much as there used to be, but even things that are redundant to me at this point, there's still room for me to improve.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, last spring, I did my very first steam bent laminations. And of course, as a friend of mine who is one of the greatest woodworkers I've ever known, his name is Craig Young. He lives locally. He always gives me a hard time. He calls me Ragnar the Viking because apparently I'm just hard to get rid of.
That's funny.
I hope that's endearing. I never thought about that. Anyway, he always laughs at me. He goes, Matt, you always cut your teeth on the hardest version of something in woodworking possible. He's like, you just like the pain, man. I did steam bent laminations and I freehanded them, no jigs. I actually freehanded the pieces symmetrically to each other. That ended up being part of the lateral support systems underneath the long table, but were also really cool and decorative because they had all these twists and bends, and that opened a whole new door for me.
Yeah.
And I just hadn't gotten around to that yet. And there's still stuff I haven't.
Yeah. For the audience, can you give us like a real like low level description of what steam built lamination
is? Oh, steam binning. Yeah.
Yeah.
So steam bent laminations, it means you build a box, you have a steam making, you know, apparatus or machine, which is actually one of the cheaper things in woodworking and great for felt hats, by the way, if you want to shape them.
Okay.
You know, you put the wood in the box and there's more to it. Like you have to know about what your thickness is and like what the temperature inside the box is and how long it stays in. And what happens is there's a certain thing in the wood called ligna. And when it gets steamed, it loosens. And ligna is actually what makes the wood, it gives it its hardness and density. So when it's steamed, it actually will kind of change the structure. And I know the science people out there might correct me on that one.
Yeah.
But it makes it to where you can actually manipulate it a little bit. So when I pulled one of these strips out of the steamer, I had about 7 minutes at best to get it just where I liked it.
Okay.
And then I'd get it where I liked it, clamp it down, and I clamped it live to the workpiece. I didn't have any pre-made things to hold the bend overnight and all that. It was because these were a lot of twists and turns.
Yep.
So I'd have that. I get it locked in. Then I go grab the other piece, and then you got 7 minutes, man. Like, go. And so it's cool. But there's a process. And I remember because I guess I'm getting cocky, or I am cocky. My wife came in when I was doing it. I showed it to her. And she sat there and looked at it. I got all done. I looked at it, I said, home run, is that good?
Yeah.
Because it was awesome.
Right.
That piece is still one of my favorite I've ever built. It's actually at the Wren restaurant.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, that, and not trying to caveat.
No. Well, that, I mean, I appreciate that. And that's actually the perfect segue because one of your recent commissioning works was Wren in Bentonville, which is Matt Cooper's new restaurant. Mm-hmm. And really cool place. Matt Cooper of Conifer fame, and before that of Preacher's Son. He is a Preacher's Son.
He's just a cool dude.
He's a cool dude. He's an amazing chef. James Beard nominee multiple times, just like Chef Raphael and a few others that are here. We have some talented mm-hmm. chefs here in Northwest Arkansas, just like we have some talented woodworkers here in Northwest Arkansas. What made that project, and I'm speaking specifically of Wren, special?
Ooh, in hindsight, I look back on it and, you know, not every style of piece I can build is in there. It's a decent volume of work. And at one point I giggled. I'm like, I feel like I'm getting paid to do my greatest hits. I really just loved that job. The spirit of it really appealed to me.
Yeah.
So much that I actually reshuffled other workload around to be able to fit it in mm-hmm. because their timelines are really tight. And usually I would raise an eyebrow there because it's really hard to produce good stuff fast, especially at volume. Because I mean, I think my one help guy, he's part-time. I think we knocked out almost 40 pieces in less than 3 months.
Wow.
Yeah, I was tired.
That was
I'm 45 now.
So you put a lot of work into that.
Yeah, I think I took 2 days off from March till mid June.
Yeah,
but the spirit of that place is what really got me, man. And the food part, I'm not a big foodie, and not that I think that's a bad thing. Everyone's kind of got their jam, so to speak, or no pun intended. I totally understand it, and I felt like Chef Cooper and I have a lot of things in common. But to me, it was the spirit of that restaurant. When I first went in there and looked at it, it was just studs. They were still getting it rolling, the building redone. But I understood kind of the spirit of what he was doing. And to me, that restaurant, that is the closest you're ever going to get to getting an invite to Chef Cooper's house.
Yeah.
And him cooking for you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I really liked that because it felt more authentic than just a regular restaurant. And then him talking kind of just loosely about what he was kind of hoping for. But for the most part, they gave me carte blanche. You know, they saw, I guess, my body of work. And they were like, honestly, why don't you take a look at this room and tell us what you think?
Yeah.
And they were awesome to work with. And they really respected my ability to just go in there and get her done.
Because you originally, correct me if I'm wrong, but when you originally went in there, you were just going to do one thing for them, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And then it ended up cascading into other things.
So I think they ran into the same thing that a lot of people run into when they hire me around here. Or it's what I run into with everyone. And it's just what it is. It doesn't bother me a lot. But most people in Northwest Arkansas don't really know I exist. At least that's what I think.
Sure.
I've always just thought it was kind of cute. You know, like, well, okay, that sucks. I'll build for anybody. I love building for people here.
Right.
And they actually, I was referred to them by, in my opinion, the greatest concrete furniture guy in the world.
Okay.
Brandon Gore. He's unbelievably talented. The project manager, I guess, is friends with him, and Gore told them they needed to call me. They had never heard me, which is fine. So when I showed up, they were actually just inquiring about the front door, and they asked me, you know, for some numbers on what they wanted. And I said, here, that's what that looks like. I said, however, I said, let me sketch you a couple things also, because you could probably have a door you don't even know exists. So I sketched up and mocked up several sculptural doors.
Yeah.
And they saw that and they're like, yes, please. And so I think after that, my guess, I don't know, is that they looked at my body of work and they're like, who is this guy?
Right.
And then they realized, you know, it was like, oh, you know, and that was another part of that process. It was so cool because that was right in the middle of Chef Cooper being nominated for the Beard Award.
Sure.
And I remembered, I've been there. You know, I won my first national award. How long ago was it? 10 years ago? 8 years? I don't even know. Like, I kind of remember the excitement and the nerves and the expectations. And so there were several times I go, because I was delivering stuff almost every Friday. It got to where my wife was wondering what I was really doing in Bentonville, you know?
Right.
I'm being cute. But I've been checking on Cooper and just be like, how are you doing, man? Like, how are you? Like, you doing all right? You know, I really like them a lot.
But yeah.
But to answer the question, I guess, completely, the spirit of that place is what really got me, especially like the private dining room. There is a wall of shelves. That's probably the only thing in the room I didn't build. It's full of his personal cooking books.
Yeah.
It's like his altar. I mean, it's just cool.
Yeah.
So when I saw that, I'm like, I get this, you know, and I sculpted the entire like kitchen island that he cooks on, and it's very on display, and it needed to look like it was made by a human. And it needed to look like something that wasn't coming out of just a factory, but it still needed to look like it came from an amazing factory, you know? So I don't know. I just really felt like the vision of that place, the spirit of it really blended with who I am.
Yeah. You know what REN stands for, right?
Remember your name.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. It was something his grandmother. Yeah.
No, I remember when he told me that. I was like, yes. I like that.
It is so Matt Cooper when you hear that story and then you're just like, okay, that all makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
So like even the first time that I sat down with him and, you know, and he was telling me the whole story about his dad, you know, actually preached at the church that was across the street from where the preacher's son was. And so, you know, and that's, it's just, it's really interesting. And it's funny to hear those stories. And he was one of the first restaurateurs or chefs that I had on my podcast. And he's actually been on several times to talk about Conifer and now to talk about REN. But I look at him as an artist. I mean, he is second to none when it comes to just crafting and putting disparate things together that you eat. And you're just like, where has this been all my life? Right.
Exactly.
And in the same vein, the work that you do with woodworking kind of elicits that same response, I would imagine, from people where they're like, Matt Buell, where have you been all my life?
Well, I hope so.
This work with this beautiful creation.
I did hear secondhand comments during the restaurant build that there were some high-end designers and stuff that came through, and that the repeated comment in first reaction to my work there was, who the expletive is this guy? And it's kind of funny. I guess what I should say is, be careful what you wish for.
Because
I remember when I was a kid, the person that I thought was the coolest in the world was Roller Wilson.
Okay.
I grew up in Fayetteville. There's nothing more locally born and sourced than me.
Yeah.
I mean, people like me. I was born and raised here.
Right.
So, you know, Fayetteville, I can remember, God, I'm getting that old, when it was very different.
Yeah.
And Roller Wilson, he still lives in Fayetteville, I do believe. And most people don't even know he exists. And that guy sold paintings for like $50,000 for how long? Decades?
Yeah.
So he has like the perfect life. He lives right off the Fayetteville Square. I'm probably ruining it for him right now.
Right.
I'm saying that out of respect.
Right.
Like when I was a kid, he signed a print for me because my mom was a fan. I got to meet him once.
Okay.
And it like was life changing.
Oh, man.
But I always thought that that's when you've made it, is when you can go to New York or Los Angeles or to a bigger city and get a big check and then go home to your small town where you're comfortable. And you can just be you, you know. I was at an art showing many years ago, which I don't get out of the house much. I don't.
Or the shop.
I don't. Well, I mean, excellence comes at a cost. And yes. I'm not saying I'm there yet, but I'm pretty good. And I was at this art thing. And I remember I was standing outside talking to this really nice young guy. He started woodworking. And of course, that just excited me. I'm like, oh, yeah, well, tell me what you're working on, you know. And so he starts talking. And and he goes, you know, he goes, there's one guy around here I would like to get a hold of. He's like, his work is on a different level than everybody else. And he starts describing, I was like, well, tell me about his work. What's it look like? You know? And he starts describing this piece of furniture and I'm sitting there and I'm like, as he's going through to the descriptors, I'm like, this guy ripping me off. And I finally looked at him. I said, what is that guy's name? He goes, Matt Buell.
Oh.
And I looked at him and I just put my hand out. I said, well, it's incredibly nice to meet you.
Yes.
And he just went, oh my God, that's the most Batman thing I've ever seen. He's like, wow. And I was like, I think that's cool.
I know. I know.
Maybe I gotta get out of the house more.
Wow.
You know?
Wow. That's funny. So you said Roller Wilson.
Yeah. Roller was one of my idols growing up.
I'm going to have to look this dude up. I don't know why I don't know him. And those of you that are listening that know who he is and you're saying shame on you, Randy, for not knowing him. I apologize. I will figure it out. I'm new to the area. I know I have 11 years here, but I'm still learning new things about Northwest Arkansas. That's what I love about this place.
I haven't seen Roller. I was in his presence once or twice as a child.
So yeah.
For all I know, he's going to be ticked off that I even brought his name up.
So,
I don't know, but
yeah.
I'm a huge fan.
Sure.
And that was a moment in my life that was very, very motivating, inspirational, and really showed me what the standard is.
Yeah. Yeah.
That you don't have to walk around with the big ego, that you can just enjoy life the way it is and still be great at something.
Yeah, I love that. Listen, I know, and I kind of want to switch gears here a little bit. I know you've spoken at national events and you've judged youth competitions.
Mm-hmm.
What's the message you share with the next generation of makers?
Lots of them. So I've been the host of the Young Wood Pro National Contest for 3 years now. And I'm also one of the judges on the panel, which is a whole other story I'll get into another time. It's like I'm sitting next to people I used to idolize. It's wild. So every month I will do an article and a video that's really be kind of throwing out some just suggestions or strategic tips to help young woodworkers that are just now getting started in the industry, because the goal is to let them learn from a lot of my aches and pains along the way so that they don't have to.
Yeah.
Because the way I started out, I had no guidance, no tutelage, no help, no money. I mean, my dad's a very successful guy, but you know, asking for help wasn't something I really wanted. I'm too prideful.
Yeah.
So my goal has always just kind of been one of those things where it's like, I want to help these guys and gals have the easiest, softest path they can, because it's already hard enough as it is. And so that's really the spirit of most of the articles. And everything. I mean, but it's very business minded.
Yeah.
You know, I don't do a lot of like how to make a table. I mean, I feel like the universe of YouTube is already overflowing with good and bad versions of that. Mine's more about like, hey man, you're a professional. This is about running a business. This is about being a professional. This is the things that are going to come up as a professional. Shop layouts, logistics problems, client problems, contracts, doing inventory on your stuff, little weird tricks that have worked for me. I think the biggest thing, I'm a big proponent of right now. So I was just a keynote speaker at the largest woodworking show in the country a few months ago. And the topic they handed me was how to get young people attracted to being in the woodworking industry. My first response was, really? We've been talking about this for 10 years and we still are asking the question. We should already have a plan. And then I've worked with power tool companies, you know, and I have good relationships and all of them want that.
Yeah.
And we've been talking about it forever. It's just like no one's ever on the same page. And that's the biggest problem. But
it's a problem that all the trades struggle with.
Though. Yes.
Right. So it's not just a woodworking thing. I mean, HVAC, plumbing,
absolutely.
They all.
The trades in
general.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it has to do, and not to go off on a tangent, but no, a lot of it has to do with the fact that we have not esteemed that type of training and or path for our young people.
Absolutely.
The way, like, I mean, when I was growing up, I mean, my mom was like, you're going to college and there's no other way,
right?
You know, and I'm like, okay, great. Now, I'm glad I went to college. I will never, never exchange my experience for anything or trade it. But there are a lot of young people, men and women, that, you know, the trades could be a tremendous opportunity for them.
Huge.
And not only a tremendous opportunity for their own well-being and the ability to put food on their own tables, but it can also be a leg up for them economically.
Yeah.
In some tremendous ways. I mean, when I look, my son had a friend of his was 2 years removed from high school, decided didn't want to go to college. By the time we saw him 2 years later, he's making like $90,000 a year. with no student loan debt or anything.
That's right.
Like that, working in the trades. And so it's not rocket science.
No. And I just, the older I get, the more I just try and, a wise man taught me once, if I'm arguing with somebody, I'm just wrong.
Right.
I lack perspective. Now there's certain moral things I think we're wrong and right are probably pretty apparent. But outside of those,
sure.
Usually I lack perspective. And the way I've kind of evolved looking at the issue is there's nothing wrong with going to college. There's also nothing wrong with not going to college.
Right.
You know, I think it's a generational thing too. I think that there's a context of what was happening society-wise when we were growing up. Trades jobs, which were also associated with manufacturing jobs, were all outsourced.
Yeah.
And so what you had in the vast middle of the country, and this isn't political, I'm not going there, I promise. This was part of the speech I gave. It was like, we need to realize that we are multi-generations removed from having a workforce that actually physically likes building and doing stuff.
Right.
Or fixing stuff.
Yeah.
And not only that, but there's this nasty connotation that got stuck on doing that kind of work, because when all of the manufacturing left, then everyone was like, well, I have to go to college. An office job is security.
Yeah.
And anything that's not that is shameful. And that really is the rolling connotation that was really baked in the late 90s.
Yeah.
And so now we have kids that are coming of age who are being raised by the kids, us, who were told, hey, that's not the path.
Right.
And the irony is, it's just not a one size shoe fits all. And I made more money on some of my better years doing furniture than I would have in my best years as a private practicing clinician.
Yeah. You know, and it's really interesting too, I think, with the way things are moving. And this is, at the time of recording this, it's 2025.
AI.
And there's this little thing called AI out there. And we were talking about this before we started hitting record, about how, you know, you were talking about how you lean into AI for certain things. And I was just listening to your use case. I'm like, yeah, I guess I kind of do the same thing. But I mean, that is fundamentally going to change everything.
Fast.
But I don't know that AI is going to be able to build any wood sculptures.
Well, the robots have been doing my job for a decade now.
Well, but I mean,
I've seen it.
Yeah. But I mean, at the level of creativity and inspiration, you know, and that I think is the difference. Because you could certainly make the same argument that if you train an artificial intelligence brain long enough, you could teach it to write like Hemingway or anything else. But
it'd be impressive.
It would be impressive. There, I just think that there is some
AI drink whiskey.
I don't know. But at least we won't have to worry about a DUI or anything like that. Right. So yeah, but no, but well, but I just
robo-taxi. I don't know.
Right. Yeah, just you don't know. But seriously though, it's like we've almost come not full circle, but we've come 180 degrees from where we were like, oh, you know, white collar jobs, all these. This is the way to go. And now all of a sudden, all of that is under duress. And under stress.
Yes.
And people are like, man, I need to get back to doing something with my hands, right? So everything that Mike Rowe had been screaming from the mountaintops for the last 15 or 20 or 30 years is coming to fruition right now.
And just, I want to put this out in the universe because I don't know Mike Rowe.
Yeah.
But Mike Rowe, if you ever hear this, please give me a shout. I'd love to talk.
Man, if Mike Rowe's listening to my podcast, I'm doing something. So,
no, because I mean, I would gladly, Mike Rowe or anybody, and I've had some discussions of recent with stuff I can't really get into on here, kind of getting on board with some other people.
Yeah.
Pushing harder for the trades work. But it's really important that I say this. The people who are doing the jobs in the offices, they matter to me too.
Oh, yeah. You absolutely. Know,
I don't have like a office jobs are bad mentality. I think there's just never one true path for everybody. Mm-hmm. And that's been my biggest thing with the trades push for the youth. It's not like a, hey, you need to do the trades because it's the best. Like, I don't know. It's been great for me. You know, like you need to be open.
Yeah, you do need to be open. And you know, I've had a chance. So I spent some time in Germany growing up. And,
very trade-centered.
And I studied.
There.
Yeah, very trade-centered. And the reason why I was going there is because actually our exchange student that's living with us right now, shout out to Miguel. He is 16 years old and he's going through an apprenticeship at his school back in Austria for IT. But his sister, who is a year or two younger than him, is going through a culinary program. So this young lady is 14. She's already identified that that's something that she would like to do.
She'll or be at least a sous chef by the time she's 16 or 17.
Absolutely. But I mean, she's already starting it.
Mm-hmm.
And her peer here in the United States is kind of being forced to take a million different classes and things that they may have no interest with whatsoever.
And they'll be working in the kitchen, working their way at paying off student loans.
Yeah. And that's a challenge. And that's that in and of itself is the one thing that I think if we could learn something from what they've done in Europe and probably some other countries, but specifically in Europe, they've over-indexed on creating outlets from a perspective of trades that gives everybody kind of a path. And you can take this path or you can take that path. And I mean, I just think that's something that as our country is as great as our country is, there are some areas of improvement that we can use. And I think with individuals with your skill set and background, you will be able to speak to the power and the possibility of what that track would look like.
I'm the worst and the best guy to have in the room with the youth because the truth of the matter is they have no excuse.
Yeah.
I couldn't even build a box when I was 30.
Right.
I mean, I remember I did a huge marketing campaign at the request of Festool, which ironically is a German tool company.
Yep.
I use their power tools because they're superior.
Yeah.
If Americans could make one of those, I'd gladly switch. But the results are superior and I'm a professional. I need good results and I need them quickly. And, you know, if a router dips, I blow a $5,000 workpiece.
Right.
Their routers don't dip. It doesn't move. The depth gauge is perfect. But I remember that campaign. That was one of the reasons they loved me, was because I was already being seen as, you know, one of the best amongst my peers in the entire trade. And I'd only been doing it at that point for like 6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
And they loved that because it's like they loved it because they could use me as a way to dare people who are on the fence about getting into the work and trying out their tools. It's like, well, what's your excuse?
Right.
You know, but that's the thing. There's nothing wrong with trying.
Yeah.
It's the fear of failure that kills everybody. It's like, go fail. Please, go fail some.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and fail often. I mean, my thing is, you know, and I keep telling my son, Nathan, who came here to spend some time with you. And
cool kid, by the way.
Thank you very much.
I enjoyed it more than he did. We got to talk ball and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, you talked a little bit about everything. So, you know, I keep telling them, you know, especially for young men, like I'm speaking specifically for men. So all of you parents out there that have a young man between the ages of like 15 and 20, recognize that their whole front section of their brain isn't even fully formed yet.
Yeah.
I've been giving my kids license to make mistakes. I told my oldest son, Joshua, who's 20, I'm like, dude, you got till about 25, 26 until you start really getting it all come together. I mean, he woke up late this morning for school and he should have been at school on time, but he missed it. I'm like, but he's 20. So you got to have grace for that, right?
Yeah.
And I think that too often we want our kids to grow up so fast that they miss the process of actually maturing.
Yeah, which a lot of times just means enjoying the consequences of their own choices.
Absolutely.
Good and bad.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the thing. It's not always bad.
No, it's not always bad.
You know,
it's not always bad.
It's just, I'm a big fan of autonomy.
Yeah.
You know, within reasonable boundaries, like letting people go experience what they need to experience.
Yeah.
I don't need to be right.
Yeah.
I'm too old to care about being right.
So tell me this, and I mean, because, man, we could talk all day about
the trade
this,
thing, especially. I care a lot.
Yeah. And I've done stuff with the Northwest Arkansas Council because they're really big into that. And there are a number of trade programs that are really viable that a lot of design firms participate in. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, there's one event, Build NWA, where they pack out a local hotel in Springdale every year, and they bring in all of the different trades. And then the kids can come in, they feed them Chick-fil-A, and then they let them try out stuff. They bring commercial vehicles there. They show all of that to them.
That's cool.
And yeah. And the thing about that's cool about Northwest Arkansas is that you're starting to see facilities in places like the Center for Innovation and others that are saying, okay, I see that this is where things are headed. We're going to create opportunities and a platform for young people to kind of embrace all of the different options that are available to them. I mean, you can get a CDL. You can take a CDL, get a CDL license going to the Center for Innovation. You can work a forklift. You can learn how to use all of those different heavy. Yeah. all of those different heavy machinery equipments. You can do that right there in the safe confines of the library. I mean, that's kind of, to me, that's the investment that Northwest Arkansas has put into our young people. They just need to be able to take advantage of it.
Yeah, they need opportunities. They need options. And then once they find some options that look enticing, they actually need to have some sort of infrastructure where they can actually go pursue it.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm a huge fan. I probably need to get more active with the local networks as far as being more hands-on with
Well, I can introduce you to some people.
And I do love teaching. It wouldn't surprise me. Depends on how a few things go in the next 6 months or so. But down the road, it wouldn't surprise me if I just open up my own school.
Yeah, I think it would be valuable. Because, I mean, that was going to be my next question, was how you balance mentorship with running a high-level...
It's hard.
...custom design shop.
It's really hard. So I take on apprentices sometimes. There's a lot of training. These machines are wildly dangerous. And I always get the same question. Which one's the most dangerous one in the shop? My answer is always the same. The one that's on. Because they'll all maim you or kill you, you know, right, if you're not paying attention. It's a really difficult balance I'm still working on. There's some jazz for you. Because a lot of times, depending on how far along someone's trained, they can help, you know, work on professional pieces in process to a point in the process.
Yeah.
Which in all honesty, as I get older, that's usually the front end or the back end, which is the milling and the cutting and the lifting and the sanding.
Sure.
Those are the two things I want to do less and less as I get older, right? So it works out. But there's that dance of, am I having to stop and teach so much that I'm not getting my job done?
Yeah.
And so it really, when I have some slower times, that's when I do more teaching. And when I'm slam booked, either if someone's good enough and already up to kind of take the training wheels off and roll, then they're in here rolling and I work with them. If they're not quite ready yet, then we just take a break.
Okay.
Because it's not fair to them.
Yeah.
Because what'll happen is I'll be so busy getting my end of stuff done and I might turn them loose on something too soon.
Yeah.
And they can get hurt, or equally for their pride, they'll botch a work piece really bad, cost a bunch of money. And I'm not going to be mad at them because I'm going to know that's my fault ultimately.
Sure.
Bad boss.
Yep.
But they still got to carry it around,
yeah,
you know, emotionally. And that's the idea, is for them to be able to grow and make mistakes that are recoverable,
yeah,
in their mind.
So
it's a dance.
It is a dance.
And I'm sure it won't, at some point, if I were to go more into teaching, I would probably do 3 days work on studio work and 3 days a week teaching.
Well, yeah, because I think the power of that is that would be an extension of your legacy. You know, imparting that to some other people.
Oh, it's completely selfish.
So I said
that.
It's kind of like, you know, you look at all those students of like Frank Lloyd Wright and all, Faye Jones and all of the designers. And you're like, well, oh, yeah, so-and-so was a student of fill in the blank.
There it is.
So-and-so was a student of Matt Buell.
Well,
the Matt Buell from Northwest Arkansas?
That'd be weird. But that's the truth. In any aspect of life, the greats. One thing that makes them great is how much they are students of their craft.
Yeah.
Look at Kobe Bryant.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, he could tell you who George Gervin was.
Yeah.
And why he was important. Yeah, yeah. The first Kevin Durant.
Yes.
That matters. And I actually, in the speech I gave recently in Vegas, I've done a lot of speaking engagements this year. They do run together. I've got one more left.
Are any of these on YouTube?
The one from Vegas will actually, it was, they call it a WED talk, a woodworking TED talk.
Okay, cool.
And that should be uploaded.
We'll make sure we put some of that in the show notes so people can see
it. I haven't seen it yet,
close
so
and personal,
let me know if it was any good or not. I don't know. But I remember saying something to that effect, that I care, and I genuinely do, because the craft I do is given something to me.
Sure.
And the way I see that is much greater than myself. Mm-hmm. And so I owe a debt.
Right.
I still want to make my living, but I owe a debt.
Yeah.
So it's important, the things that I've been given, talent-wise, God-given, however you want to put it, I need to give some of that away.
Yeah.
But selfishly speaking, if I keep going hard in 20 years from now, maybe I make it in the top 10 woodworkers of my generation. Well, if there's not another generation, who's going to be around to know it?
Right.
But I like that, because there's also pressure that comes with that. It's not all glory. I have to carry the weight of inspiring.
Yeah. Yeah.
The real big problem that I see right now is social media has been awesome at just getting the thing out there so that the youth can even know that woodworking or being an electrician or any of those things are even a thing.
Yeah.
But it's also put us at risk, especially in my craft. It looks to me most of the time like we're selling the youth the performance of woodworking and not the actual job.
Yeah.
And so that bothers me a little bit, but all I can do is just show them, do what I do.
Yeah. And put it out there for folks so that they can really see what it's all about, right? And I think that's important. I want to ask you this as we land this plane. What has, or rather, what ways does Northwest Arkansas shape or support your work? You know, I mean, how has, you know, and I guess maybe a better way to phrase this would be, as a canvas, Northwest Arkansas, the area being a canvas for you with your woodworking. How has that shaped the work that you do?
You mean like inspirationally?
Yeah.
The people?
Inspiration, or? The people. I mean, has this been a good base for you to do your work? Have you found
absolutely
that to be the case?
Absolutely.
You're from here.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm asking that as an outsider, right? Because I mean, sure. I've been here for 11 years, but I still feel like
considering
I'm an outsider.
I started my business during the Great Recession. Telling you, I just didn't care. I had
right.
to do it, didn't care. The first thing I would say is the people. I'm not a very social guy. I don't really get out much, but there's been some incredible people that became clients and some being friends that really gave me a canvas, so to speak, to really just go.
Yeah.
Like Fayetteville, the city hall. I sculpted it.
Okay.
You know, that was an amazing opportunity, you know, to be able to do something I know that'll be sitting there when I'm gone.
Yeah.
That my daughter, if she just misses me one day, she can go up there and just
take a look at it. Yeah. You know, that's the beauty of, I think, of woodworking and creating anything in general. I know when I was in Germany, I studied a guy named Tilman von Reimenschneider, who was a, what's the best word? He's a woodworker. He's a carpenter. And his work still 400, 500, 600 years later still exists, and you can see it and touch it and look at it.
It's a tactile experience.
It really is. It really is. And it just takes you to a whole nother level. And you're like, man, this was created like back in the 13 or 1400s, and it's still here to this day. So
no, there's a magic to it.
I mean,
I've not been doing this for so long, or maybe succeeded a little bit or enough to have lost touch with the magic. How it all just starts on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
And just an idea.
Yeah.
And then you're somewhere in the middle of it, you get 15 splinters and you've sliced yourself wide open and, you know, the client's screaming because you're 2 days behind. But somewhere in the middle of it, there's this magical moment where even though it's not formed all the way, that picture on the paper, you start seeing flashes of it.
Yeah.
In 3D,
you
know, and it's like, ooh, ooh, here it comes, you know, and it's like, well, what's the next part? Let's get to that, you know?
Yeah.
But then afterwards, you can always relive it because it's right there.
Yeah.
Now, I'm romancing it pretty hard.
I love
it. It's also really hard work. I don't want to sell it to the kids in a way that's not honest.
Right? And I know you shared that with Nathan. And I told him, I said, you want to get into this. This is something that won't come easy.
No.
And you will have to put your time in.
And as soon as it gets easy, the wood will do something weird to you.
Exactly. Like, yeah.
It's humbling.
It will humble you for sure. All right. Last question, I promise.
Nice.
This is actually a selfish question for me, but it's for everybody. What advice would you give someone who thinks it's too late to start something new? 30 years old, you got into woodworking. Probably when you were 20, if somebody had told you that in 10 years, you're going to get into woodworking, you would have been like, oh, that's crazy.
I might have even punched them.
Yeah, you might have even punched them. Because you were on a different track. So,
20, but, I'm not really sure what I was doing, to be honest.
But the bottom line, you know what I'm saying? I mean,
it's
never too late to do the thing that you're called to do, which I really resonate with. But what would you say to someone who's saying, oh, it's too late to start something new?
Well, my ridiculous intellect would be like, well, it depends on the context of the person, their limitations. Da, da. Truth of the matter is, it all comes down to, what do you want your tombstone to say?
Right.
You know, I mean,
what do they say? Make the dash count, right?
Yeah. I mean, if there's something that's calling you and it's not harming anybody,
answer the call.
Just do it. I mean, yeah. What do you really have to lose?
Yeah.
What are you going to lose that you were planning on taking with you?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, but I don't know. A lot of times, luck matters and obviously finances matter, but there's a lot of moments in my job where it really just came down to how bad do you want this and how far are you willing to go to get this? You know, was it 12 and 15 hour days for a year straight with 2 days off?
Yeah.
Okay. I found out that I was that willing. Okay.
There you go.
But I don't know. I just don't think anything's out of reach if you're realistic and you're willing to do the hard stuff. So there's really no.
Yeah.
It just comes down to, what are you afraid of?
Yeah. It's crazy. You know, you look at all these people that, and now, again, that was a truly selfish question for me. But as I think about some of the people that I'm highlighting in a talk that I'm doing and just what they overcame, and obviously everybody knows Colonel Sanders' story, but they don't really know his story.
Sure.
Like multiple failures, like multiple, like dude slept in his car when he was in his 60s.
Yeah.
Trying to figure things out. And trying to get those 11 herbs and spices onto the dinner tables of millions of people. And in his 70s, was able to sell KFC. And it was a global product. And that didn't come without some pain and heartache.
Nothing does.
No.
I mean, nothing
no,
real.
No.
I mean, I think it has been my experience. I'm always asking questions of people that I think are successful.
Yeah.
Or that they have something in their life that looks like something I would want or that would work for me. My favorite question to always ask people, and it's wild because it's counterintuitive, but that every one of them, every time I do it, the different people always have the same response. They light up with joy.
Yeah.
I always ask them, what were your favorite failures along the way? Because it does two things.
Right.
Any fear I've got of failure about trying something is automatically negated.
Yeah.
Because I realize, oh, well, they failed a bunch too. And look, we're okay. This must be part of it.
Yeah.
So there goes that irrational thinking is out the door. But once you're on the other side of a lot of that, or at least it's really probably, there's always something. But once you're on the other side of a lot of that stuff, you love talking about that stuff because that's where you learned your best lessons.
Yeah.
Like a lot of times the failures I've had or the places where I've been wrong have been the springboards that actually propelled me into where I needed to be. So it's like,
yeah, why not?
Yeah. Like what, pain?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure every human's pretty familiar with that is. Like,
sure. Oh man. No, you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, sometimes we hope, I always say if you're not going through something, then you're really not living. And that's like one of the best pieces of advice that I can give a young person, right? I'm like, if you think everything is going to be hunky-dory and that it's going to be effortless, think again, you know? Yeah. And my grandmother used to remind me, she used to say, trouble you will have with you all the days of your life. So you have to just deal with it.
And pick your trouble wisely.
And then the last thing she said, and I'll end with this, is that she used to also say when you were going through something that was really hurting you, she told a young man this, some advice. He was in the hospital at the time and, you know, on his, almost on his deathbed at the age of 23. And my grandmother told the man, she said, don't waste your pain. And he has taken that with him
That's really good.
Life. Yeah. Don't waste your pain, because we all go through things in life that really, you know, can wreck us if we let it. And this guy, it has one of the largest churches in Columbus, Ohio. Now he has got a wife and kids and grandkids, and he's in his 60s now, but he always reminds me that was what sustained him, that advice that my grandmother gave him when he was 23 years old in a hospital thinking he was going to die.
Yeah.
And my grandmother said, don't waste your pain.
That's really good.
And he took it and ran with it and never wasted it. And I mean, the fruits of what he's been able to do since is something.
You know, so. I think about, because that's amazing. And it really just rings true to a lot of kind of the isms I try and live by. And to me, you know, the path to being good at something starts with humility.
Yeah.
Because I'm not going to improve at something until I've spotted where it is I lack.
Yeah.
Or where I need it. And that requires the humility to say, huh. Yep. I got some work to do there.
Exactly.
You know, but
yeah.
But then once you cite that and you see that, you got to go do it.
Yeah.
And that's where people, I feel like they get stuck.
Yeah.
They get so stuck in kind of just whipping themselves over the fact that they're not perfect at something or that they're messed up in one area. It's like, no, man, that's just the work. Just go do it.
Yeah.
But the pain thing is interesting. Something I've been learning as I've gotten older, pain is a great teacher. It gets me to stand up at attention and gets me real teachable.
Yeah.
But I feel like I'm gaining some wisdom in learning life is going to dole that out just fine.
Yeah.
I don't need to go find some extra so that I can get extra humble and be extra teachable.
Right, like, right.
I kind of let the universe keep me right size.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Because yeah. At a certain point, there's been so many times I'm like, now, wait a second. Is that me just asking for pain because right. I'm bored and I need to learn something?
Right, right. Well, but sometimes I think we just find ourselves in an unpredictable situation.
That's life.
And you've just got to push through it. Otherwise, you know, you said obstacles the way. So you.
Yeah, Marcus Aurelius is one of my favorite readings.
Yeah. So
Marcus Aurelius
who knew
Malcolm
you were
going to
throw a little,
my go-to.
a little stoicism in there. But no, I appreciate that, man. This has been really rich. Matthew, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. This was long overdue. This was a long podcast. We're kind of in Joe
Rogan.
No, it's all good. We're in Joe Rogan territory here, but I think it was well worth it. And more importantly, there were some things shared that I think young people need to listen to. And I'm going to certainly make sure that my sons listen to this episode and they share it with some of their friends, because, you know, there's just some really good advice. Not every data point or every piece of advice that you're going to get is on TikTok or Reels or anything like that. Sometimes you just have to listen to some good
stories. It's very manicured at this point.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. Absolutely. But seriously, though, Matt, thank you so much. If people want to reach out to you, they want to connect with you, they want to buy your work, what's the best way for them to do that?
Imbuel Studio.
Okay.
Is my website.
.com.
Mm-hmm. And my contacts on there, but I also...
And that's B-U-E-L-L.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And also I have the social media stuff too.
And we'll put all of that in our show notes and make sure everybody can connect with you. But we really want to support you any way that we can. So.
Well, I'm grateful and likewise.
Yeah.
Thank you for your taking the time. I hope I answered your questions, at least in a way that was understandable.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. No, I appreciate it. Thank you so much, man. And we'll look forward to having a part two of this conversation. So, as I like to say, we'll put a comma here.
Deal.
And a period.
Deal.
All right.
This has been fun.
Perfect. Perfect. All right. Well, Matt Buell reminds us that mastery isn't about where you start. It's about how much heart you put into the journey. In a world chasing speed and scale, Matt is carving a legacy one meaningful project at a time. And Northwest Arkansas, honestly, is all the richer for it. Listen, guys, I hope you enjoyed this episode of I Am Northwest Arkansas. I'm your host, Randy Wilburn, and we'll see you back here next week with another new episode of I Am Northwest Arkansas. Peace.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of I Am Northwest Arkansas. Check us out each and every week, available anywhere that great podcasts can be found. For show notes or more information on becoming a guest, visit IamNorthwestArkansas.com. We'll see you next week on I Am Northwest Arkansas.